Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. There are a lot of science-focused podcasts out there.
You're listening to Radiolab.
This is Invisibilia.
This is Science Friday.
This is Star Talk. I'm your host, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Here in the Bay Area, we have a wealth of scientists. And in a sort of manifest destiny kind of way, there are quite a few who are producing their own podcasts based on their fields and research niches. One of those local podcasts includes Carry the One Radio, produced by research scientists based at UC San Francisco. Basically, in each episode, they bring an experiment or idea they've been toiling with in their labs to your ears. They also interview other scientists from various fields about what they're working on. I'd like to share with you an episode of Carry the One Radio, wherein their team brings us new conclusions regarding how physical exercise in humans may increase the production of new brain cells in adults. Here's Carry the One producer, host, and scientist, Sama Ahmed.
Okay, there I was, 9 years old, and my brother and I had to go to the gas station across the street from my uncle's insurance office in Philly. I can't remember what we were supposed to buy, but I do remember everything else. I remember waiting at the sidewalk with my brother for the cars to pass on our left, and I remember that as soon as the last car went by, I yelled out, "Race to the finish line, last one's a rotten egg," and I ran across the street as fast as I could. My brother didn't move. He remembered that Baltimore Avenue is a two-way street, and he saw the cars coming from the other side. I wasn't so lucky. There was a loud, rubbery sound as the car's front bumper made contact with my skinny little 9-year-old body, and it threw me under a black SUV. I went chin first into the asphalt, and I rolled around and scraped my knees and elbows. The guy that hit me jumped out of the car and yelled, "Call an ambulance, call an ambulance." He was a round guy with a big black beard, and I remember thinking, this guy looks just like my neighbor. Someone else who saw the whole thing picked me up and rushed me into my uncle's office. I remember looking over my shoulder as the door was closing and seeing the man who I thought was my neighbor drive away. The next thing I know, cops and firemen were on the scene and I was being questioned by a police officer. I don't remember what he was asking me, but I do remember looking down at the blood on my knees and feeling really embarrassed because my mom had made me wear these super tiny navy blue shorts with sky blue stripes, and I remember thinking, man, I wish I had cooler pants on. That was almost 20 years ago, and I still remember it every time I cross the street. And now I always, always look both ways for traffic, no matter what.
I can remember not too long ago, I couldn't find my way.
Hello and welcome to Carry the One Radio, the science podcast. My name is Sama Ahmed. We humans have the ability to mentally time travel to a specific moment in our past, like me in the car accident. Our memories, they help us adapt to the world we live in, and they guide our future behaviors. And all of them, all of our memories, are supported by a living network of brain cells. The thing is, until recently, it was thought that the number of brain cells, the number of neurons we have, is set at birth, meaning that adults can only start losing neurons. This means that some of you out there right now have fewer neurons at this moment than when you started listening to this podcast. But today we challenge that myth. We caught up with a scientist who works on adult neurogenesis, the birth of new neurons. His name is Dr. Gary Westbrook.
Gary Westbrook, I'm a senior scientist at the Volum Institute in Portland.
Gary studies how neurons communicate, and specifically in a brain region that is good at quickly learning memories, the hippocampus. It's so fast that you can remember something that only happened a single time. And there's something else that's special about the hippocampus.
We're interested in that particular region because that's one of the few areas in the adult brain where new neurons are continuously made during life, and we've been studying the process by which those new neurons develop and integrate themselves into the functional circuitry of the adult brain. So it's a way of looking at how we can sort of rejuvenate brain function even in adult animals.
The new neurons that are born in the hippocampus stay in the hippocampus, and they probably help us make new memories. But not all of these new cells make it.
About 50% of them actually make it. Like many cells in the brain, more cells are born than actually survive into the final process. So these new cells in the hippocampus, about 50% make it, about 50% die. We don't actually know the reason for that. There are theories about that. One of the simplest theories is the idea that one needs to make the proper connections in order to survive, sort of a survival of the fittest kind of mechanism, that if you don't make the appropriate connections with your other neurons or other cells in the environment, then you don't receive the signals that you need to survive. The ones that make it seem to integrate normally and seem to be particularly connected with as new memories are formed. So they seem to be preferentially involved as we learn new information, which is particularly interesting part of the problem.
And in mice and rats, thousands of these new neurons are born every day in the hippocampus.
We still really don't know what part the new cells play versus the cells that have been there, the so-called mature cells. So we're still working out which groups play what roles in what under what situations. For a number of years, we really weren't sure whether this happened in humans, but just earlier this year, a study came out that shows that definitively this does happen in humans, in adults. So it seems like this is a process that isn't restricted to experimental animals like mice, but also is something that's going on in us.
Gary uses fluorescent proteins to label the new neurons. This makes it easy for him to count and characterize them. He can then put the mouse in different experiments and ask, what causes more neurons to be born? And until Gary started working on this problem, it wasn't actually clear what would trigger more cells to be born.
It turns out, however, that we can stimulate the production of new cells through a variety of mechanisms. One of the simplest ones is physical exercise that actually produces a pronounced increase in the number of these cells. It's also sort of interesting that if you look at just the number of cells, let's say, in a young mouse versus a much older mouse, there are many fewer cells in the older mouse. But if you stimulate or have that older mouse exercise, their actually response to exercise is greater in the older animal. There's a very robust response suggesting that the sort of capacity to respond is retained even in the older animals.
So the mice are put on a regime of elliptical, maybe some free weights and a little yoga, and they're all set, right?
So what we do with the mice is not so different from your local gym club. So what we do with the mice is put a running wheel in the cages. And so it's voluntary running. It's not enforced. But we do keep track of it. So we put a little counter on the wheel so we know how many revolutions per day that these mice run. So they will do that voluntarily. Which might be harder to do in humans. Some humans will voluntarily exercise and some won't, right? So it doesn't seem like this requires Olympic athletes, but just modest levels of exercise seem to be sufficient.
This is a hot field, and we still don't know exactly what these newly born cells are doing. We don't know what causes them to integrate into the existing circuits, and we don't even understand why exercise increases their production. It just does. But that's where science lives, on the edge of what is known and what is unknown.
One can take this to thinking about human behavior in interesting ways in terms of, I'm talking about physical exercise, but there are other forms of intellectual and mental exercise as well that appear to stimulate the production of these cells. So this is all correlation. It doesn't prove those cells are actually critical in the function of the brain, but it's very suggestive that, in fact, they're playing an important role and can be stimulated with things like physical exercise.
That episode of Carry the One Radio was produced by Brian Siebold, Karuna Mehta, Stephen G., Demetrius Rumis, and Sama Ahmed. Listen to their back episodes, check out more of their research, and learn how you can subscribe to the show at their website, carrytheoneradio.org. That's one spelled out O-N-E. I'll also have a link to their website up on kalw.org. You're listening to The Spot, the show that features the best stories from podcasts and independent radio producers. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. We just heard about how exercise can build more than just muscle mass in our bodies. It can also build new brain cells, too. I want to take that concept even further with an episode from the podcast Transistor from PRX. Transistor is a STEM audio project where radio producers are paired with scientists to create radio stories as inventive as the science they're presenting. In this story, Dr. Wendy Suzuki introduces us to Dr. Marion Diamond, a scientist who made breakthroughs in regards to just how much environment can influence brain functions. Wendy's story is about more than just scientific research. It's also a meditation on movement, memory, and mentorship.
This is Transistor, a science series from PRX.
This is Totally Cerebral, part of Transistor from PRX, supported by the Sloan Foundation. I'm Dr. Wendy Suzuki.
All right. I often ask, who is more excited the first day of class, the students or the teacher? Who do you think? Do you get excited coming to class? I get excited coming to class.
I was a freshman at UC Berkeley, and I was taking a class that first semester of my freshman year. It was a freshman honors seminar. And so there were only about 15 students in the class. And the class was called The Brain and Its Potential. It was taught by an amazing instructor.
My name is Marion Diamond, and I've been teaching here for many decades because I love to awaken students to anatomy.
And she told us all about the brain. In fact, that very first day, I'll never forget, she was standing in front of the classroom. And first of all, she looked like a Hollywood movie star. She had this blonde, bouffant hairdo. She was very tall, very beautiful woman with a white lab coat over a beautiful skirt and blouse. And in front of her on the table was a flowery hat box.
Now, do you know what the most complex mass of protoplasm on this earth is? What do you think it would be?
She opened that hat box very dramatically, and she pulled out a real, preserved human brain.
A brain, sure, without a doubt. Can anybody tell me anything more complex than the human brain?
For a little freshman at UC Berkeley who had never seen a human brain before, that was one of the most memorable moments of my entire college career.
I want you to appreciate what you carry in the top of your heads, because this mass only weighs 3 pounds, and yet it has the capacity to conceive of a universe a billion light years across. Isn't that phenomenal?
It really is the most complex structure known to mankind. It underlies our creativity and our personalities. And not only that, but it can grow and change in response to the environment.
It is a phenomenal mass. And it's housed in a human body. They have a symbiotic relationship. The brain affects the body affects the brain.
And with all of that, I was agog and just thought, this is the most exciting, interesting, fascinating thing I've ever heard of. I'm so glad I'm in college. I want to be a neuroscientist. Marion Diamond was, well, to this day, she's the best teacher that I've ever experienced in my entire career. And it's because she was so present and engaged and fascinated, truly fascinated with the material that she was presenting. She has the flair for the dramatic, and she wrote everything on the chalkboard. She said it was because if I write it down, you're going to write it down, and that gets it into your memory. And so at the end of the class, you've already learned most of what you need to learn.
I have to tell you why I still use chalkboard and do not use
PowerPoint because I've studied learning mechanisms long enough to know that it takes time to take in the primary information and associate it. I feel if I just flash on things like this, you don't get it. If you write, you use your kinesthetic sense. That's one way. It slows me down. It slows you down. And I also repeat all the time because we know repeating reinforces. So we're using things that have been shown for learning rather than just keeping up with the technology.
At the beginning, I was captivated with the neuroscience experiments that Marion Diamond herself described and she had done. So she did these classic studies in the 1960s showing what happens to the brains of rats if they were raised in what they called enriched environments. So an enriched environment is an environment where rats had lots of toys to play with and lots of other rats to play with in a much bigger space. And you can think of it kind of like the Disney World of environments. And what she showed was the brains of rats raised in those enriched environments were actually bigger. The outer covering of the brain called the cortex actually grew significantly larger compared to rats that were raised in impoverished environments where there was only one rat in a cage with no toys.
So we decided to publish it. And I spoke to the American Association of Anatomists, the first big conference that I had ever spoken at. There weren't too many women on the agenda. When I finished, a man in the back row, I mean, it was a big auditorium, stood up and shouted, "Young lady, that brain cannot change." Nobody had thought that you could have an enriched environment specifically change a brain, and an impoverished one change a brain. This was a first. Nobody else had made such measurements and found these results. We were terribly excited about it.
Her work in this environmental enrichment and brain plasticity was so influential on me. I was fascinated both with the brain and with brain plasticity. And so when I went to graduate school, I definitely was drawn to other forms of experiments that addressed brain plasticity. And my form of brain plasticity that I became fascinated with in graduate school was memory. Everyday brain plasticity. If I learn something new, if I learn the name of somebody new, and I'm able to remember it sometime later, my brain has changed. And I wanted to try and understand what that change was and really identify it. It's funny, physiology, that is recording from brain cells, you have to say is a little bit like fishing. You don't know exactly what's there. I know the hippocampus is involved. I don't know what I'm going to find there. So I put my little fishing rod, which is a very, very thin microelectrode, down into the hippocampus so I can listen in on what these cells are doing. I would be listening to a cell as an animal was starting to learn something new. And the cell wouldn't be doing much of anything. It would just be firing every once in a while that I could hear on the audio monitor. But then, one day, I noticed that just as the animal started to learn a particular association, this cell that was on the end of my electrode started to fire more and more consistently, right as the animal was learning this, and continued the fire as the animal really put it into his memory more and more strongly. We call that consolidating a memory. He got better and better. And by the end of the session, he was performing that association at 100% correct. And I thought, well, maybe I was hearing things. But then I went back and analyzed the data, and what I saw is that this cell, in about 20% of all the cells that are recorded from in the hippocampus, would change dramatically just as the animal was learning a new association. Once I got used to it, I could actually hear this happening. And listening to those cells and being able to identify them as we listened to them was kind of like listening to the birth of a new memory. It was so exciting to find these cells. Again, it was a little bit like fishing. I didn't know whether I was going to catch a tiny little fish or a big fish. It turned out to be a pretty big fish because this was the finding that got me tenure at New York University. It was very, very important kind of professionally for me, but just so exciting because it literally took 5 years to get this experiment off the ground, to get the animals to learn and to be able to get the recordings to work. And even then, after everything was working, we didn't know what we were going to get. That doesn't guarantee success. But I have to say that I realized at that point that there was something amiss. I had turned into my own lab rat, just going from my home to work and working really hard to get all this work done and going back home and going to sleep. And, you know, I was living in New York City and there was so much out there and I was taking advantage of none of it. Not only that, I was about 20 pounds overweight because of the amazing takeout food in New York. And I realized at some point that I needed to rebalance my life in lots of different ways. And I marched straight to the new gym that opened up not too far away from my work. And I signed up. And I signed up for a personal trainer too to make sure that I would come to the gym and get my workouts in. And that was the best thing that I could do. It was amazing. You start training regularly and your body responds, just like the brain. Put the brain in an environment, it responds. That's what I learned in Marion Diamond's lab. And I was learning on my own, the hard way, that you put yourself in the situation and your body responds. It did so actually beautifully. And I ended up losing 25 pounds and I felt great.
That goes for the brain as well as for muscles. You use it or you lose it.
Use it or lose it. With use, you grow branches. With disuse, sitting around doing nothing, you lose it.
Right, left, everybody do it with me. Right, left, and I say, I am Superman strong. You say it.
I am Superman strong.
I say, I am.
I found this workout that I loved, and this is a workout that combines physical movements from kickboxing and dance and yoga with positive spoken affirmations. So you yell things out like, I believe I will succeed and I am strong now.
Super duper strong.
I am super duper.
First move is push it.
I loved it so much that I learned how to teach it myself.
Okay, deep knees.
And once I got to this kind of higher level of working out regularly, something quite amazing happened. I noticed changes in my brain. What did I notice first? Well, the first thing I noticed was mood. My mood was just sky high. And we know that this is happening because exercise enhances neurotransmitters that increase your mood. Neurotransmitters like serotonin and noradrenaline and dopamine, the neurotransmitter important for reward. But it wasn't just that. I noticed that my memory was better. I was able to pull things out of my memory and put them together and new and interesting ways better than I had before. And my attention was definitely better. I could pay attention longer and stronger throughout the day. So we know that exercise can change mood. Exercise is shifting and increasing certain neurochemicals and neurotrophins, growth factors in the hippocampus that enhance the birth of brand new brain cells in the hippocampus, which should blow everybody's mind. It blew my mind when it became clear from the rodent literature that exercise can speed up the birth. It gives you more brand new hippocampal cells, and those hippocampal cells live longer and incorporate into your hippocampus. I know how important the hippocampus is for memory, and I want as many new hippocampal cells as I can get.
Here we ask, what do you want in your life? What are you working for? I say, I want it. I really, really want it. You!
What is the mechanism that physical exercise that is moving your body and getting your muscles active and getting a sweat up and getting your cardiorespiratory rate up, how exactly is that changing your brain? I've told you about correlations. You exercise and you get increases in neurotrophins and increases in different neurotransmitters. We still don't know exactly why they're going up. And that is a fascinating question. And so my dream lab is to have multi-level questions being asked. At the human level, we're going to be doing these behavioral studies and identifying the tasks and also looking at the patterns of brain activity using functional magnetic resonance imaging to show how the brain is changing after exercise, but have collaborators doing work in rodents and other species so you can ask those questions about what are the factors from the body that are affecting the brain. It's a real mind-body kind of question that I think is so fascinating, and I want to be able to put those levels of questions together in this kind of new direction that I'm going. So as I became more interested in the effects of exercise on brain function, I went back to look at the literature to try and understand where these findings had originated. And I realized that these findings came directly from Marion Diamond's original observations that when you raise rats in enriched environments, their brains get bigger and stronger and have more neurotransmitters. Those original studies that inspired me as a freshman. It turns out that we later found that a key component of those enriched environments that were making all of those amazing brain changes was the increased exercise that the animals got in the enriched environments. So when I realized that, it was like a sign. It felt like I was coming home to my original love in neuroscience, and I knew that that was the right scientific question for me. Marion Diamond has not only influenced my science, but she's profoundly influenced my teaching as well. I've now taught hundreds of students in an introductory neuroscience course, and I have to tell you, I have my own hat box now. And every time I lift that brain out of the hat box, I bring Marion into my classroom. You've been listening to Totally Cerebral from PRX, produced by Julie Burstein, with editing and sound design by Derek John. Location recording by David Gorin in New York. We've had production assistance today from Nell Waxberger. Our executive producer is John Barth, and we've had help from Genevieve Sponsler and Lily Bowie.
For more from the podcast Transistor, visit their website, transistor.prx.org. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. And tell me what you want to hear on The Spot. If you have a suggestion for a podcast we should feature, please drop me a line at thespot@kalw.org. Tune in next Thursday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on KALW San Francisco.